As if by magic. Hello and welcome everyone to today's Brave Conversation here in London. It's absolutely wonderful to have so many of you with us today. We do these conversations all across our hubs, all around the world, because we like to create comfortable spaces to have uncomfortable conversations and talk about the things that really matter and push boundaries. And tonight's no exception. So when we choose our subject for these conversations, we think about it carefully in that we want to have people join us that will really truly bring their whole selves to the conversation. So Peter said I can ask him anything, so I intend to. And there will be lots of time for all of you to ask questions, so feel free and get involved. I think we've got mics coming around at that point to be able to do so. So he'd welcome any conversation, you said. Excellent. To Peter, I was sitting next to him at a breakfast recently where we were hearing from another brilliant chief executive, an outgoing chief executive actually sharing his story. And I sort of said to Peter, would you fancy doing this one day? And he was like, you never know. Within a week, it was announced that Peter was the interim chief executive of Just Eat. So I got in touch and went, that was quite timely. Do you fancy coming to talk for us? So here we are tonight. And that's kind of how things happen at the Marketing Society. I think he needs very little introduction because he has, you know, a quite significant profile for very good reason in our industry. But he was appointed interim chief executive in January after joining in June last year as chief customer officer, being responsible for all digital data, marketing and operations activities for the group. Before Just Eat, of course, he was known for his time at EasyJet and the incredible journey that he had there alongside Carolyn McCall and the rest of the team. And he, most notably, his role as Chief Commercial Officer and behind the airline's successful transformation. Previously at Audi, Barclays, and if that's not enough, independent non-exec director of Close Brothers Group. So wearing quite a lot of hats and got a big career. And as you're here tonight, digital and data-based retailing are in Peter's blood. From launching the internet bank from Barclays to the hugely successful reinvention at EasyJet. So quite an impressive chap to have a conversation with, which I'm very much looking forward to. So without further ado, Peter Duffy.
That was too kind.
Thank you. You look nervous.
I am very nervous. Don't really like this sort of thing, as you know. Hello, everybody.
Well, thank you. So, what's it like being chief executive?
Yeah, it's quite a shock, actually. It's quite different because you sort of know the company, so you sort of think it's going to be broadly the same, and then perhaps it isn't, really. So I think the most notable thing is I spend my time with just entirely different people now. So the advertising agency, long forgotten, it's now sort of Goldman Sachs and UBS. I talk to shareholders, I meet stakeholders, you know, it's just an entirely different community of people. So that's the thing that I think has surprised me most. And I guess you don't have much time. That's the other thing. When we were just chatting about this before we kind of sat down, you just go from one thing to the next and your time is sort of scheduled out for you, really, and you feel a bit like you're being pushed from one place to the next. You lose a bit of that sort of control. So, yeah, I guess, 3 months in, more different than I thought it would be.
So ad agencies or Goldman Sachs, more fun? Which one?
There's that. Do you know what? Stand against each other, you can guess which one's which. Advertising agency, a lot more fun.
Have you got that down?
No. Yeah. Sorry.
What attracted you to Just Eat in the first place?
So Just Eat is a really interesting company. It's a brilliant company. So first of all, it's like FTSE 100, which is kind of a bit of a surprise to a number of people, but it's a massive global organisation. So we have operations right across Europe, Canada, Australia and Brazil. And it's this huge, fast-growing consumer change. So basically, more and more of us are ordering food digitally and having it delivered to home. And so Just Eat started off about what you and I would call takeaway, about pizza, kebab, Chinese. But now many people in this room may have something delivered this evening because they're just busy, they're getting home from late, and you may call us, you may call delivery, you may call Uber Eats, and you'll have something kind of delivered to you. So there's this huge change in consumer behaviour. I was in Beijing just before Christmas, and they are seeing people sort of order 80, 100 times a year, because, you know, just the consumer behaviour shift is enormous. And that's what we're going to see happening here. So it's a digital company. It's a tech company. Wasn't using data much. So massive opportunity to begin to do things differently. Really young company, average age 32. It went from 28 to 32. I think that was me joining, kind of dragged that average up. So really kind of...
diversity, very important.
Really dynamic and kind of, you know, highly energetic, highly enthusiastic. And at times, if I'm honest, a little bit chaotic. But just a brilliant place to be, really. And I'm kind of quite intuitive, so I like a vibe. So if I go in somewhere, I sort of think, do I like it here or not? Do I like them here or not? It feels good. It feels like a good
Brilliant.
Place.
And just the fact that it's a global operation that's grown incredibly fast. So you talk about, you know, the transformation of the way we, from takeaway to now. It's been very, very quick, hasn't it? And particularly, you know, for Just Eat. Does that make it difficult to manage?
Yeah, so we have sort of, you know, 30% plus growth rates, top line per annum. And yeah, it's do you know what? It's really tough. Mm. Actually, I was in Sydney all of last week. So just getting there is tough. Actually, it's quite a long way away. Mm. And so you can't go very often. So the team there don't get to see you. And so when you then want to contact with them, obviously, it's a start and the end of the day. And yeah, everything has to be thought about, really. And they can feel remote if you don't begin to put quite a lot of effort in. And the logistics people are all in Canada, in a place called Winnipeg, and they call it Winterpeg because it's kind of winter from sort of October through to April, from what I can see. And, you know, that's a very different cultural part of the organisation. So how do you connect those people into London? How do you connect those people into Sydney? How do you make all of that kind of come together? So it just all needs thinking about, really. It is difficult.
And so how do you cope with different food cultures in different markets?
Different food cultures. So what's genius about the product is it sort of self-selects. So what we do is we curate all the restaurants in your area. So if you live in West London, there's probably lots of sushi and there's lots of, you know, salad and there's lots of, you know, small things. I'm a Scouser, I come from Liverpool. And so if you kind of go to Liverpool 5, you probably won't find a lot of sushi, a lot of salad there. So all we're doing is we're just bringing together those restaurants and we're delivering those restaurants to the customer. And we're starting to do things like prioritising the things that you order regularly and the things that people like you order. And, you know, all the logical stuff that you'd expect us to begin to do is all beginning to happen. So it sort of doesn't matter what that restaurant is. That restaurant will change by locality, by country. Canada's all about branded restaurant groups. The UK isn't. So the three biggest things that people order online are still Chinese curry, kebab. None of those are delivered by branded restaurant groups in the UK. In Canada, everything is a chain. So, yeah, it's just sort of self-selects. It's kind of different.
So I'm going to go back to your time at EasyJet.
Yes.
I'm sure we'll come back to Just Eat a bit later on. What did you learn? I mean, you were there for 7 years. Mm. So what did you learn from your time at EasyJet?
Oh, blimey, everything. I mean, what an extraordinary organisation that is. I think there's something about a 24/7 organisation that flies 90 million people a year, and you know, stuff always going on, always going wrong. You know, regardless of what. So I think, you know, you learn to. Somebody will come up to you and say, Kate Moss has just been on a flight from Bodrum and called the crew member a basic bitch. And you kind of go, no, I don't think that's happened. And then you find out it has happened.
Has that happened?
Yeah, oh yeah. and then you'll find that, you know, a crew person asked somebody who was breastfeeding to stop. And you go, what? What? And then, yeah, no, it did happen. Okay, what do we do about that? Or a man with a guide dog, you know, not being allowed on the plane because his paperwork wasn't perfect. And as always is the case with EasyJet, it transpires he was going to speak at a conference on travelling with guide dogs. And everybody then comes to you and sort of says, how can you let this happen? And you can't, yeah. So there's something about an organisation like that which is just full of everything and keeps you on your toes.
So I guess, you know, one of the things when we had a chat before, You were saying how you've been a spokesperson for many of the different businesses. And I remember on the phone you saying you've sometimes had to justify the unjustifiable, which I guess some of those things might be an example of that. But Tell us a bit about the challenges you've had here, and if there's any specific. Well,
these things that, you know, genuinely we wanted to make things better for people. So if you were flying with some sort of disability, we wanted to help. We wanted to make that better. And then so when things go wrong, you've got to really look at that and understand why and how you fix that and how you make sure that doesn't happen again. How you sort of use these really bad moments to begin to drive change through the organisation. We set up an advisory group chaired by David Blunkett, you know, the former Home Secretary, to help us understand what it was like to be flying with a disability. Because I don't know how many people in this room have a disability, but you know, if you don't have one, you don't instantly begin to understand the issues. So how do you actually raise that level of organisational understanding? So I talk about justifying the unjustifiable. You know, I had to go to the Transport Select Committee on that, but in a way, that's a good thing, because you know, because you are saying, yes, this happened, it wasn't good enough, we do need to do things better, and you're then taking that responsibility on yourself to try and drive that through the organisation. So I see that as a positive. But I think in terms of, I think I may have been talking about when I was at Barclays, I was lucky enough to be the spokesperson when Barclays tried to introduce a pound to take cash out of a cash machine, which, as you can imagine, was not the best ever consumer story to be supporting. Claire, I don't even think Claire was there. It was before Claire, and we, in true Barclays fashion at the time, obviously they're much more polished now, Claire. They timed it with shutting 200 branches and then running an advertising campaign that said a big world needs a big bank, and it was like a little cocktail of stuff which you think, how did all that happen together? and I ended up, that was probably the first time I was on the Today programme, you know, trying to justify it to the business editor on the Today programme and Channel 4 News. And it's tough, actually. I think that, you know, the purpose of a story actually is that when you're kind of at the early stage of your career, actually doing really difficult things is actually quite helpful. It's quite developmental, because even today, I sort of think to myself, well, it can't be as bad as that time you were on the Today programme talking about a panel, because obviously nobody, no consumer thought that was even remotely acceptable to do. And so it was justifying something that kind of wasn't right. And I think, you know, as you get a little bit older and perhaps more senior, you can make sure that the organisation doesn't get itself into those situations. At the time I was 32, yeah, that's kind of my excuse, really. So how do you make sure that the customer is front and centre of everything that you do? And I feel that over my career, I've got the scars of where that hasn't been the case, and you see it from the other side. Another time I was ended up on the 9 o'clock news at the time was, you know, when we first launched internet banking and customers could see other customers' bank details. And you know, it's really important. You know, internet security, so many people think is such a dull topic area. Well, when you've been on the 9 o'clock news trying to defend it, you become a bit more interested and a bit more focused on it.
But how do you defend something like that?
Well, you can't. So the important thing is it's brand and reputation. So you know, any of the organisations I work in, if the customer doesn't think it's safe to keep their credit card details in, you're in trouble. If it's a bank and they don't feel that their information is safe with you online because somebody else is going to see it, you're in trouble. So you have to kind of go right up to that highest level of customer need and brand reputation and make sure that that's what you are protecting. And if that means that, you know, the first thing to do is hold your hands up and say, we've got this wrong, I'm really sorry, what are we going to do about it? At the time, we pulled internet banking. We shut it down because I just couldn't. Mm. I couldn't guarantee what the problem was to know that it was going to be sortable. So the best thing was to shut it down, to get it fixed, to get it right. And it's in some line of code, you know, sort of. I don't know how it happened, but and I think it was out for a few days. But you know, preserving the reputation of the brand, I think, has to be the number one thing that you do. And that means you apologise and you just say, we've got that wrong.
And so many don't. So there's a lot of learning there, actually, isn't there? Where, you know, just being human and being open and being honest.
So I think at my time, I've had my fair share of corporate traumas, really. And I think the rule of it all is absolutely right from the start. You've got to say what you know and what you don't know. You've got to be open. You've got to be honest. Don't try and spin it, because that will unravel really quickly. Just say, this is what's happened if you know it. And if you don't know it, say, we don't know and we're looking into it and we'll come back to you on it. I think it's really important.
So what's been the defining moment in your career to date?
Dear, defining moment. Well, for me, it's all about people, really. And I guess when I went to EasyJet, it was all a bit chaotic at the start there as well. And so we needed to build a team from scratch. And when some of the people I'd worked with previously said they'd come, and it wasn't great at the start. So, you know, they were coming to a tin shed in Luton and the pay wasn't fantastic and we were getting pummeled in the press and our shareholders didn't like it very much. And there were lots of reasons why you would think there was somewhere better to work from here. So the first time that sort of people said that they would come and do, that was good. I kind of thought, yeah, the way you do things, I think, is quite important. And that was the first time sort of people said, yeah, come on, let's sort of do some stuff together again, because it was fun last time and we can do this and it could be fun next time.
Mm. As you know, one of the things that the society is very passionate about is bravery and brave leadership. Do you think you've had to be brave to change the fortunes of EasyJet when you were there with the rest of your team?
It's funny, old word, bravery, yeah. So if I look at what we did at EasyJet, EasyJet was a very, very operationally led business. So what do I mean by that? The way EasyJet works is you have to still get 8 flights in a day and they have to be on the ground for 25 minutes to go again. That's a plane going up and down, that's what I'm doing there. And if you miss that 25-minute, 30-minute slot, you kind of miss the final 2 flights. So you take 25% of the revenue off. So it's kind of all important. And so it tries to run like clockwork to kind of get those planes going. So when people arrive with a customer agenda and start to say things, so we did something called free seating, which meant that you would just take the first available seat. And so the reason for that was that we believe that was the fastest way to turn the planes. So if you were sort of saying I'm in 14A and I was saying I'm in 8C and you're crossing each other in the aisle, it's just going to slow everything down. So just get everybody to sit in the first available seat. But when you spoke to anybody at the time, they really hated it. You know, certain cohorts particularly hated it. So people with children, actually a lot of women with children, people with children generally, but women. And even though we kept people together, there was a sort of level of anxiety we created around it. Business people, you know, didn't want to start the day by legging it across the tarmac to the first available seat.
And can understand that.
Yeah, posh shoes kind of thing. And then anybody with any level of money, actually, you got to a point in life where you just thought slightly, do you know what? I'm just a bit too good for this. I just, you know, I'll pay the extra 10 quid. I'm not going to have a fight to sort of sit there. But no research had ever been done on it. Nobody had ever even asked the question, because it was a truth in the organisation, in the industry, that that's how things began to work. So when we suggested that maybe there was a different way of doing it and you could allocate the seats, kind of like every other airline did, you know, operationally, everyone was clearly very concerned about that. So we had to begin to demonstrate that you would not actually reduce the efficiency of the planes, reduce the asset efficiency of the planes. And, you know, lots of people didn't believe that. So you had to kind of prove that to them. Long story short, the first year, it probably added 100 million to the bottom line and customer satisfaction kind of soared as a consequence. And there were lots of times on that kind of customer-driven agenda when it would have been quite easy to just sort of give up, really, and just say. So it's not that we were doing something that was stupid. It was, you know, it was done for kind of good reason. It was good operational reason. It wasn't customer first. And so, yeah, it would have been easy to kind of give up. So when people sort of don't believe you or they're sceptical about it or they're wanting proof on it, I don't know if that's bravery, maybe it's tenacity, but you have to kind of keep going. You know, we didn't have a mobile app at the time. You can't really believe now that an airline didn't have a mobile app. And so now I think probably 40% of all their ticket sales are on the app. And, you know, I remember the first day when we watched the first sale kind of come through and everyone was saying, well, it's not really very important, is it? You know, no one kind of cared. Nobody saw that perhaps consumers were going to do things differently tomorrow to how they do things today. It's one of the things I sort of take in my conversations with investors. You know, I talked to shareholders at the time. Shareholders weren't massively interested in all this digital and customer stuff. They didn't. That's not how airlines worked. That isn't what drove profit. But actually now, that is exactly the conversation they want to have, because the dynamics of the industry have changed. And that is all about a more customer-led approach. Things change.
And are you taking the learnings that you, you know, the vast learnings from that you had at EasyJet, into Just Eat, particularly around data and digital and the customer journey?
So Just Eat is kind of, it starts off with being a listing, and actually that listing last June was static. It was kind of like the old-fashioned telephone pages. So just now driving that by data and just prioritising it. So if you and I were in the same postcode, we'd see the same restaurants. Mm. But you may love salads and I may love burgers. And, you know, and so surely I should see burgers and you should see salads. How does that all begin to work? And so just being intelligent, and that's what data is. Data is all about, you know, curating content in the way that the customer finds most relevant. And just starting to introduce that and saying, you know, it can make a difference. Funnily enough, if you think that's easier to use, you may buy more from us. That's kind of how it works. We all go to Amazon now because it's just so easy. I don't want to go to Amazon, really, but I kind of go to Amazon because I just find myself going to Amazon because you just sort stuff out, don't you?
Yeah, and it's immediacy.
It's that customer friction. Taking customer friction out of processes drives value.
I mean, we do a lot of events where we talk about how to handle data within our organisations, and what it seems like is that actually no one's got the answer, and people are struggling. There's that, you know, there's many, many challenges. What advice would you give, you know, from what you've learned across the two, particularly the two last businesses?
So I don't think there is an answer apart from bring all the data together in a way that you can see the entire customer, and then I think it's up to the marketing community to then begin to make some sense of that and to begin to say, well, what are we trying to do here? And what does being customer-centric look like? Carolyn, my former boss, she was brilliant at sort of, you know, getting the focus of the organisation on the customer. But my role was, well, what does that mean? How does that, what are those programmes of activity that then begins to translate into? What are those chunks that we're going to do? And what are the important ones versus the less important ones? And I think that's what a marketing community can really begin to do. It can begin to put that definition into the organisation about the things that we should be focusing on. And you know, if we just look at data as kind of a big mountain and a big problem, it is very intimidating. It's very hard to begin to see what that answer is. If you begin to break it up and begin to say, well, we're going to do this, 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 and it all becomes a little bit easier. So when I start to say to people, well, we're going to make our listing work with your favourites first, or if we can't deliver, we're going to drop that restaurant down the list, people can kind of get that. So I think it's our job to just make it easy for the company.
Seems like common sense. Mm. Trouble with common sense, it's not that common.
Well. Wow.
So looking on back on the period, like particularly with EasyJet, are you pleased with what you did, and is there anything you would do differently?
Yeah, no, I mean, we were a great team. So, you know, Carolyn, phenomenal CEO, and the group of people who did what happened at that airline and took it from sort of, you know, profit of, I can't remember what it was, about 70 million to about 670 million at the peak, and the share price went from £3 to £18. And customers went from not liking it to liking it. Mm. It was a great moment to be in. It was a great team to be part of. So, yeah, no, I think, you know, I'm really proud of what we did. Yeah, there's tons of things that you do differently. I mean, tons and tons of things that you do differently, and loads of stuff that we kind of got wrong. But lots of that's hindsight as well. You sort of look back and you think, you know, I would have done that differently now, but you didn't at the time.
So if you think about one of the things that you've got wrong, whether it's EasyJet or somewhere else, because we always talk about, you know, you most learnings you get from adversity and from failure. Is there anything that comes to mind that you learned a lot from that went spectacularly wrong?
So I think my biggest mistake at EasyJet was a people mistake, actually. Blimey. So the oil price had gone up and we needed to cut costs and we needed to reduce the size of the team, and we all decided that that's what we were going to do. And there was a brilliant person in my team who had checked in the first passenger to the airline. She had done pretty much every job in the airline. She was doing some brilliant customer stuff for me. And in looking at sort of raw numbers, was somebody who was identified that we weren't going to be able to take into the next phase of the organisation. And that didn't sit very comfortably with me, but I kind of agreed that we were all going to have to take whatever it was, X percent off, and that was the consequence of what happened. And what I completely undercalled was that she was just the most amazing culture carrier for the organisation, for the customer. It wasn't just the job, it was the importance. She was a figurehead, really, for so many people. And when she left, so much was lost. So much was lost. For how much cost? I mean, just was a nonsense. It was just a nonsense. And so I think about that regularly. That's the one thing I wake up in the middle of a night and think, how did you let that happen? How did you get that so spectacularly wrong? So I think there is something about brilliant people and making sure that you look after the brilliant people who are around you and you support the brilliant people kind of regardless of the macro environment that's going on. There's something about recognising the brilliant people who we work with who are so much more than the job they do. They are, as I say, culture carriers, or they're influentials, or they represent an awful lot for the organisation. And kind of, again, if you kind of get into any position of seniority, you have a responsibility to make sure that that kind of corporate history isn't lost, that those people are somehow protected. Lots of the rest of us, we can kind of come and go, really. It doesn't really make a bit of difference. But there are some people who are just crucial to an organisation. And I think about that regularly. So I look at my own teams now and I think, who are the people who are just really the ones that define what we're trying to do, who really are respected by all their colleagues, who are the ones who are really kind of pushing for the right things to begin to happen? And how can I help them? How can I support them? How can I encourage them?
Yeah. So talking about that in terms of people and how important people is to an organisation, we talk a lot about bringing your whole self to work. As a leader, how do you make sure you, I guess, you do that? You know, you're very, as we would say, you're very you, which is why you're here now, which is a compliment. You know, you bring yourself to everything, it feels like. How do you encourage others to be able to do that so they can truly be themselves and truly be great?
Well, I think the important thing is to just be yourself, isn't it? So I think it's helpful being a Scouser because you don't have many airs and graces, really. So you're grateful for everything.
You really don't sound like a Scouser, I have to say.
I say there's a her and my chocolate eclair. I can't say that AI sound that way. I think you've just got to start off by being yourself and understand what your values are and the things that matter to you, and make sure that you're communicating that on a regular basis. So one of the little things I do, I just do a stupid 3-minute video every week, just telling people what I'm up to, where I am,
nice.
Just having a bit of a laugh. They call them dad jokes because I think they're funny, but nobody else does. And kind of just, you know, getting a bit of my personality communicated that says to people, you know, it is quite hard 9 to 5, so we can have a laugh while we're at work. We do need to be respectful for all of our colleagues. We need to make sure things happen, but do it sort of in your own way. So I think the first thing that you have to do is just be very, very authentic to yourself. I'm like a family bloke, so I want to leave at 6 o'clock. I don't want to be working at 10 o'clock. Particularly when I became the CEO, if I emailed somebody, they email me back. So at the weekend, so I quite like to clear my inbox just because I feel okay about that. And then I found all these emails coming. People had obviously taken their Sunday afternoon to go and do something, and I felt terrible about that. So kind of I wouldn't email people out of hours now because of reaction kind of I get. So just trying to think about it from other people's point of view, the impression you create, the impact you have. The bizarre thing, again, that happens when you become a CEO is people listen to you.
goddammit.
But you say stuff and kind of then people go, and you think, oh, I didn't really mean it, actually. I just sort of said that kind of thing. And so thanks very much. But, so you say I'm hungry and someone goes and produces a sandwich. No, I don't want a sandwich. So it's just...
You want a burger.
You've got to be yourself, and you've got to think about it from the other person's point of view. I always think it's the role of a communicator to make sure that the other person, the communication has been received. If you don't get what I'm saying, it's not your fault, it's my fault. So you just have to think and adapt.
And do you think the way you're being as a leader is trickling down into the organisation? So what you just talked about with email, I mean, that's one of those things where I remember a team member of mine saying to me years ago, when I wake up at, 6 o'clock or whatever, I've got, 20 emails from you. And I didn't think about the fact.
Yeah.
I was just clearing my inbox. I didn't expect
stress.
Exactly. So I stopped doing that years ago.
There she goes again.
Exactly. Exactly. But how do you think that's trickling down? Because, other people's behaviour is saying, actually, I'm going to leave work at 6 o'clock. I'm going to not email at the weekend.
Well, it doesn't. So I do the Friday clear out. So we have these sundowners, and we have kind of a DJ playing. You go up for some beers, and I kind of try and clear the area out and get everybody to kind of go. And they just look at me sometimes and they say, well, we're too busy. And you kind of go, oh, I'm going, come on. All you can do is try, and people have to make their own value decisions around that. I'm trying to push decisioning down into the organisation. So I think one of the things that's happened at Just Eat over the last few years is that senior people want to make all the decisions, and actually I don't really want to make the decisions. I want the people who are close to the issues to make the decisions, because you spend all the time on it. So if that's what you think we should do, we pay you quite a lot of money, so kind of go and do that. So how do you empower people at kind of at different levels to just get done what they want to get done? So am I making progress there? I don't know. I think it's a job that never finishes, really. I think all you can keep doing is saying, this is how I kind of see the world. It's like an ecosystem, isn't it? So you've got your home life and you've got your work life, and you've got to find that kind of right balance. And I do think that is all your responsibility. So we all have jobs which are too big for the number of hours that we have to kind of work in. So if we don't prioritise, no one's going to sort that out for us, really, in the main. But you've got to know that that's an okay thing to do. So I think it's my job to say, it's okay, please think about it and go and do all that good stuff that you want to do at home. But it's your job to then stop doing it. And say, I'm not going to behave like that.
Yeah, you can only do so much. I remember one of the things we talked about on the phone, one of the things you've set up recently is a mental health programme within Just Eat, and it's something that we're very passionate about. The society is talking about, you know, we've all got physical health, we've all got mental health, and we should be able to talk about it.
Yep.
And the more we're finding that we're talking about it all around the world, the more we're opening up that space for people to say, as Ruby Wax said at one of our events, it's okay not to be okay. So tell us about
to start, it's just space, isn't it? So just going and talking to somebody who isn't kind of involved, isn't going to be judging, it's not going to help you or not help you. It's just a neutral kind of environment for you to begin to talk about stuff. And so we're just making sessions available to anybody who wants them. And actually, the take-up is absolutely amazing. Yeah. So I think we've tried to encourage everybody to go on a taster one and then go and do as much of it as you want to begin to do. And if there are more, you know, deeper issues that you want support with, then we've got different kind of routes that you can kind of go off from there. But I think, you know, life is busy and complicated, and we just need to look after ourselves a bit. And space, a bit of space, is a start. I think it's a very small thing that we're giving, but I think it's quite an important thing.
Absolutely. And on that note, I think it's time to bring to the audience into the conversation. Who's got a burning question for Peter? And we've got mics. So if you can wait till the mic comes. Oh, come on, there must be some. Yeah, here we go. Lovely. And if you just say who you are, Will.
Hi, I'm Will. I'm the venture director at ZAG. We're a creative agency that invests in startups. So it's a bit of a geeky tech question. but obviously you were the first mover in a market. Now you've got these hugely well-funded people coming in. You're straight at the helm. You've got to revolutionise an organisation. That's just a hell of a lot of challenges. And you seem to be really quite cool with it. I guess, yeah, just like, what's next for Just Eat? What's your vision for the business, or are there any areas that are exciting for you?
No, you only have one question.
pick one of the above.
Forgive me, I'll get boring about it, because I kind of love all this stuff. So we used to work with restaurants that did their own delivery. And what we're doing now is working with, so Deliveroo and Uber work with restaurants that don't do their own delivery. They'll pick it up and they'll bring it to you. So we're now launching that as well. And what that means is we're making this list of restaurants get really big. So basically, you're going to have everything in your area on the Just Eat app pretty shortly. We'll have all the restaurants you kind of want to go to. So how we then get data and digital to begin to curate that and make that kind of really good for you, so it doesn't become like 200 restaurants you're paging through, but becomes something which is, you know, really focused. And then how we begin to open all of that up. So if you're vegetarian, you can just press a button, you can drop all the meat dishes out. Or if your favourite curry house is shut because it's a Monday, you can find all the other places that do chicken jar. You know, all the stuff that you would imagine that you would want to do on food, how we begin to open that up, app up. So it just becomes that fantastic you know, really frictionless place that you begin to go to. That's what we're looking at. So how do we just keep innovation going? Because, you know, Uber and Deliveroo, they're amazing companies. What they achieve, how they... I was in Sydney last week, and in 2 years, the market share that they have built has just been phenomenal. The market changes so fast that we just can't be static. So again, you know, it's all about marketing. It's all about listening to customers. It's trying to interpret what they want next. It's trying to begin to bring that to market really quickly. How do you begin to commercialize that fast? That's what we're trying to do. It's good fun.
Very nice. Any other questions? Got one here.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Lynn. I'm from Tortoise. Your story about your biggest mistake about the woman that you had to let go.
Yeah.
Have you spoken to her since, and have you told her that?
I was going to ask that.
No, I did. I took her to Ciccone for lunch, actually, because I felt really, really bad. And we drank a bottle of champagne.
I hope there was alcohol involved.
But you know, she hasn't really forgiven me, and she shouldn't, actually. And that's what I sort of feel sad, because in a way, if I'm really honest with you, I'd like sort of redemption. And she's not going to give it to me, and she shouldn't. So
she will one day.
One day. Definitely. She's doing brilliantly. Anyway, I mean, she's been fantastic somewhere else.
As you knew she would.
As I knew she would.
Any other questions? Yeah. Claire?
Oh, Claire Jean Hilton.
I was hoping she'd ask a question.
Claire and I worked together 100 years ago. You wouldn't guess that. She was a girl then.
Hi, Peter.
Hello.
So, on the spectrum of being kind to being cruel, I'll end up somewhere in the middle,
I think. I know where you're going to go.
So, you're right, we worked together 10, 12 years ago now. And so I'm intrigued to know what's been the biggest change in your leadership style.
For better or worse. So I think it's something I learned from Carolyn, actually, which is listening. She's the most phenomenal listener. And I don't say that kind of lightly, really. So everybody has a perspective. And quite often they have to be drawn into the conversation. It's almost like a qual group. The quiet person doesn't have nothing to say. Actually, listening to them can elicit some revelation that you're kind of not hearing. And so how do you draw people into the conversation and then somehow try and distill that? So I think probably when we worked together 10, 12 years ago, it was probably more broadcast. They need to say like that. And so now I think hopefully it's more absorb and it's more reflective, and I try and gather and synthesize what I'm hearing more.
Building on the leadership theme, what's the leadership trait that you most admire?
I think sort of generosity, really. So I do believe that most people really want to do the right thing. There are very few people at this point in their career who are genuinely bad, who are incompetent, but things do go wrong. And how you handle those difficult situations, I think, is defining, really, for your style. It's really easy to be kind of upbeat and fun and positive when things are going well. When things are going really, really badly, that's quite difficult in terms of how you handle those things and when you're stressed about situations. And so how generous you are around that, and how, you know, I don't want to use the word selfless, but as selfless as you can be personally at that point in time, thinking about the individual rather than you, I think people who can do that really well, I admire that. That's what I sort of aspire towards.
Excellent. Any more questions? Got another one.
Hello. I'm Amberly from ITV.
Hello.
I have a question. Is there anything that your competitors are doing that you wish you'd done first?
Good question.
Really good question. So, yeah, lots, actually. So this thing about delivery. So customers don't care about who delivers their food, funnily enough, but that sort of was a bit of a revelation in this industry. So we were only working with people who have their own mopeds. You just want to have what you want. And so that meant that our organisation didn't do delivery when it really should have got that going sooner. So that is something that we're kind of really, you know, pushing quite fast and quite hard to begin to make that happen. So that is kind of, that's the biggest issue in my life at the moment, how I roll. I was in Australia and they were doing these sort of, you know, massive kind of focus campaigns on Canberra and Adelaide to kind of get delivery rolled out quickly. That's what we've got to begin to do. So if you kind of look at certain areas of London, you see a lot of delivery bikes, you see a lot of Uber around, and, you know, we've got to get our brand, you know, which we will do in very, very short time at that equivalent level of visibility. Out of London, you'll see us everywhere, but in London, it's, you know, it's tough.
Lovely. We've got another question here and then another question here. So we'll go to you first and then...
Hi, so I'm Andrew from Co-op. So my question is, when you were at EasyJet and you had the title of Chief Customer Officer, how did people react at the time? Because obviously it was quite new versus the more traditional titles and what it signified.
So I was Chief Commercial Officer at EasyJet, but I did have that customer... that customer sort of responsibility. And people thought that customer would equal cost at the start. So they assumed it would be like British Airways and giving you a free gin and tonic, and I'd want an initiative that says we would have to do X, Y, and Z. And I think one of the things you have to do is to kind of work out the vocabulary of an organisation, work out the dynamics of an organisation. EasyJet was all about cost, never ever going to give anything away for free. So what does the customer agenda look like in that context? And actually, when you then talk to customers, customers don't want anything for free on EasyJet. They want it to kind of go on time. They want it to be clean. They want it to be friendly. They want it to be cheap. They want it to be efficient. And so actually, if the organisation is really well aligned to its customer agenda, it isn't a moment to try and make it like BA, because it wasn't and never should be. That was about me kind of getting the company and then helping the company understand that I wasn't going to make it into something that it shouldn't be. Building trust, I guess.
Mm. Lovely. We've got another question just here.
Hi, Katie from Pizza Hut. Hello, you talked Katie about it being very chaotic when you got to EasyJet. How do you as a leader then kind of work through chaos? What does that look like?
Yeah. So when I arrived, when I was interviewed, I was told there were 60 people in the marketing department. So I thought I'd gather them all together on my first day. And so I called them all down, quite a big area in the canteen, and I got down there and there were 8 people there. And 3 of those people told me they didn't think they should be there, really. and so that sort of described the story. I walked in on my first day, nobody really knew I was coming, there wasn't a desk for me, there wasn't a computer. That was just how that place kind of rolled. You had to be a little bit self-sufficient. And of course, there were 60 people in marketing, they were just scattered around the organisation. They didn't see themselves as one community. They all acted autonomously, and they really didn't want to begin to work as one kind of collective team. They were French, they were Italian, that's who they were associated with. They weren't marketing, they weren't, you know, that's not. So actually providing a vision and some clarity around that and why that's important and what the benefits of working in that way are is really important. I think how you tell that story in a way that people buy into it and kind of understand why it is you're trying to do what you're going to do and what their role is in that, I think is kind of crucial before you then get going on each of those individual bits. The same was Just Eat, really. Just Eat was sort of very country-based. You know, everybody is in their countries. So, you know, Q4 of last year, we made 8 different ads at the same time. We have 49 agencies on our roster. So we're just moving to one creative agency, one media agency. It's relatively radical as an organisation, for our organisation, no, for no one else. But that's kind of how... So you have to paint that picture, you have to tell that story, and you have to break it down into bits. You can't do it all overnight. You just have to kind of make progress over time, really. And I think getting on with people, being nice. I mean, I think if you can just get on with people and get them bought in personally, then it's kind of easier than if you're all shouty.
Such great advice. Another question just here, Martin.
Thank you, Gemma. Yeah, Martin Lote from Propeller Group. I've actually changed my question about 3 times given your last few answers, but you just mentioned right then going down to one creative agency and one media agency. I'm sure there's a lot of agencies in the room that would love to have your business. So How do you decide what agencies to get rid of? Give us some tips what we should avoid.
Well, I'm going to make myself very unpopular now, aren't I? When you get this wrong. I haven't pitched a media agency in a very, very long time. You know, the thing that shocked me more than anything is how much value we've unlocked as a result of it. So you think you've got great relationships. You think that the existing incumbents are doing the best thing for you. And then you go and do a pitch, and then you find that they'll really sharpen their pencil in a way that you didn't think was kind of possible. And you think, hold on, let me have a little think about that. That wasn't kind of how it was. I think the days of lots of specialist agencies are kind of receding, really. For me, the complexity of doing lots of individual things versus having someone knit it all together for me externally, that outweighs it. So if you have small internal teams, which really are kind of, you know, the brains of what it is that you should be doing, and then you're looking for your agencies to begin to support on the implementation, you know, a company that can begin to just carry that load broadly and begin to integrate all that work is really beneficial. So at the airline, we have VCCP who just perform such a range of stuff for us, from, you know, internal communication to brand work to advertising through to all sorts of, you know, they designed the liveries on the plane. They did all sorts of stuff, and that's why it all felt so integrated, because we just put that accountability over to them. Your question was, how do you choose? For me, ultimately, it's on relationships. So you know, the brand above the door is one thing, but it's the people that you're going to work with. And are you going to get on with them? Are you going to trust them? Again, when things go wrong and you need some help, you know, how's that going to work? If you pick up the phone, is that going to be something where they'll kind of get you and they'll support you? I think it ultimately, it just comes down to people and relationships. Everything comes down to people and relationships.
Great. Answer the question, Martin. Happy?
A bit of procurement value as well helps.
We've got another question. Oh, here. There we go, with the mic.
Hi, Josh from BT. Hello, Josh. You've explained through your progressive career that you've kind of shifted from industry to industry to industry. Do you feel that that's enabled you to get to a higher level throughout your career than potentially staying within one industry?
So I don't know what higher level means. So I was at Barclays for 12 years, and I felt that was too long. And so I wanted to go and do something very different then. And Barclays, I loved Barclays. It was such a brilliant company for me, but it's quite rarefied air. You know, it's Canary Wharf, it's in a tower block. And so I love the idea of going and working with car dealers in Stratford-upon-Avon in kind of Stafford and Crewe. You know, can you function there as well with people who are kind of selling stuff? And so I think for me, that was kind of really good to just go and do something which is kind of very, very different. And then I see EasyJet to have been a project. It was less a job, and it was more, you know, how do we take something from this and make it become that? And then I've just sort of ended up, you know, that kind of, I think things come to a natural end. I think roles that they're like chapters or companies, you just do them for a certain period of time, and then, you know, you're ready to move on and you just want something fresh, almost for the sake of doing something different and having something fresh. And I think going from industry to industry, I mean, it's not to say that one thing is better than another, but I do think it helps keep you fresh. It helps keep you current. I think, you know, everybody thinks that their industry is particularly competitive, particularly complicated, particularly unique. And often it's not, and those problems, I think if you're on the agency side, you see that. I don't think you see that in the same way on the client side. And you find those skills are transferable, and actually you can begin to more rapidly help because you've seen it before and you've done it in a different way. The CRM system I'm implementing at Just Eat at the moment isn't radically different to the one that went into the airline. You know, and so you can bring value quicker, I think, from just that breadth. But the problem is headhunters don't want people. They want you to do the job you did yesterday.
Exactly.
So if you're a bank person, then they want you to do a bank job. So you have to be a little bit more cunning if you want to begin to do that. You really have to put quite a lot of personal energy into making that happen. And that's why events like this are really important, sort of networking opportunities. you know, meeting people. You know, all the jobs I've got have come from meeting people, really, and just sort of getting on with them. And they were, you know, it was never the plan, but it ended up that's how it happened.
Very nice. Got another question.
Hi, Chris from Freemavens. Assuming that the performance of Just Eat in various countries will differ, some performing better, some worse, what's the process you've got for best practice dissemination across the various disciplines?
So, Jenny, that's the biggest thing I'm focused on at the moment. So we've got this delivery business in Canada. It's the only nationally profitable delivery business. Every other delivery business in the world is kind of losing money. And what I am really keen that we do is just replicate that. Cookie cutter it, take it into another market, and not try and fiddle with it too much. But of course, people then want to add their magic to things, and so you don't want to say just do this, please, don't do that, please. You need to let people play with stuff and make that work. But so that's why I was in Australia last week, literally working with them to say, so how can we take as much of this as possible that's standard, but also what's the stuff that you're adding on top of that, and how can you know, you begin to share that back. That again is about people. It's about getting people to talk to each other, getting people to spend time with each other, getting people to really understand how things work. And the problem with a global organization is you just have to fly them around the world to just kind of say go to Sydney, go to Winnipeg, go, and you know, so it's just encouraging people all the time to talk, to just connect and to talk, and to not try and ideate or solve problems in isolation, but to do that collaboratively. And they sound quite glib words, really. I'm conscious it just sounds a bit, but I do put a lot of energy into that, and all my communication is saying, please just connect with each other, talk to each other. Please don't email, go and wander over and talk to them, because there's just greater value in you doing that than solving the problem. It's kind of building a little bit of a relationship. It's just, it's good.
Nothing beats face-to-face.
Nothing beats face-to-face.
So true. And eye contact, I think, is...
Sorry, key. I said I was supposed to look at you, wasn't I?
No, not at all. I think we've got a question.
She's so scared.
Not at all. There's a question from Hugh Burkett here.
Oh, I love
you. And there's another one. Right, one more question and then you, Hugh. And this lady.
Rebecca from Brand Learning.
Hello, Rebecca from Brand Learning. I'm a fan of Brand Learning, isn't it?
So, as a marketing leader, what would your one piece of advice be to someone that's just starting their career in marketing?
Well, I think it's a great choice. So I say to my kids, that ages me, doesn't it? The one thing I can pretty much guarantee is whatever they'll end up doing doesn't exist today. So when I started out, there was no such thing as a low-cost airline. There was no such thing as a food delivery platform. And you know, my son's 18 now, going off to uni, and whatever he ends up doing, I am sure won't exist because of how that works. So there are some truths which just have to sort of rise above everything that you have to stick with, which is listening to your customers, which is genuinely trying to shape an organisation to deliver what the customer is saying that they're going to do, which is making sure that your communication is kind of focused and kind of compelling. We could list all those things out, what they are. So I think marketing is fantastic because that will sit above any technology solution, whether that's driverless cars or AI or whatever it could particularly be. So I think it's a great, great choice, but stick to your customers. Keep listening to your customers, and they will always, always give us the answer.
Very nice advice. And I think we've got one from Hugh.
Hello, indeed.
Our largest shareholder after Stelios at EasyJet.
You broke it here. Now, Peter, as Gemma's already said, we were terrifically excited when we saw you taking over at Just Eat so quickly after arriving as the top marketing guy. You're the top of the whole company. So we really hoped, or we still perhaps hope, that you're going to be the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer of Just Eat. And you arrive as interim. You're apparently interim, but you're really going to, I'm sure, doing already so brilliantly, you're going to take over. But I read in the press, you say that you don't want to do the job long term. Now, are you just pushing your price up? I mean, are you negotiating? Or is there some lack you feel in your experience so far that means you're not the right person for the long run?
No, I've sort of said it's a private thing. It's very interesting.
The one question we were avoiding, Hugh, so well done.
So I think a couple of things. I think as a CEO, you've got to get an alignment between four areas, really. Your board, your shareholders, the people in the organisation, and your family life. Yeah. And I think the one thing that kind of gives in that is the family life. And actually, you've got to make sure that that is all going to kind of work and be okay. And all that can kind of change. You know, different companies can work in different ways, and family life can change at different points in time. But just there's a moment when perhaps it doesn't quite work. And better to be honest about that, I think, and just sort of not put yourself forward for a process. I love my customer job. I think, you know, I've done all right out of that up to now, and so I don't want to get disconnected from it, and so I don't know how life will change tomorrow. You know, different opportunities will kind of come up, or how that's going to potentially work. But at the moment, it just feels like the right thing for me to do, to stick with what I'm doing. So
good for you.
Vague answer.
Love that. Any other questions before I bring it back? Yeah, go.
Hi.
Hi.
Polly, also from Brand Learning. Kind of on to that, a follow-up to that question. Do you feel like your kind of deep experience in marketing has changed the way that you take on the chief exec role? And do you see going forward more people kind of moving from CMO to CEO? Or do you think it works better in other...
So I think traditionally lots of people would say CFO to CEO is a very, very natural route. You can understand why. You know, I said at the start about the people I kind of hang out with now, and being, you know, you can understand why that's the case. Gavin Patterson actually said something that really resonated with me, which is, I think if you're a marketing person, you sort of get the deal with the customer. I'm not sure if this was his language, but you kind of understand the deal with the customer. You understand what resonates and what doesn't. And that is kind of tremendously helpful, I think, as a CEO. Because what is this company all about? What are you trying to deliver fundamentally? That's not sort of, you know, the numbers will be good and not so good and good and not so good. You know, it's never linear. But what are we trying to achieve here in the medium term, in the long term? And how do you keep that customer centricity at the heart of everything that you want to do? And so, yeah, I think it's a real advantage. And I think you will see more people coming through from the customer CMO route. I do believe that will happen. I've got no evidence to kind of back that up, bar the fact that companies are just going to have to stay ahead. They're going to have to be listening to customers. Essentially, every customer is sort of, every company is sort of salesy in its kind of orientation.
We did a breakfast with Debbie Hewitt, who's the chairperson of BGL, who own Compare the Market, and I would say Meerkat, I guess that's the power of branding, and White Stuff. And she said this is our moment as marketeers. And she said she guarantees that in the next, looking at you because you were at the breakfast with me, but in the next 10 years, there will be more chief executives coming from a marketing background than we've had in the last 40 years. And she said, and the reason for that is because we understand the customer.
Is that a financial services guarantee?
I'm using it. I was like, can I quote that? She said yes. Didn't she? You were there. But she said, this is our moment. And she said, and she talked about, who's the chap that's on her board for my post office? It's Royal Mail. I can't remember right this second, but we'll remember. I can tell everyone later. But she said that he's on her board. And when he talks, he just brings the customer in such a uncluttered, simple way.
So I do think that then has ramifications. I think, you know, we have to be financial as marketers. We have to be commercial as marketers. I think the days of those brand campaigns with sort of nebulous objectives that I think they're gone, really. You know, from time to time, I still meet people that sort of say to me, oh, I'm a brand marketeer, and I'm not really sure what that means anymore.
No.
So, you know, this sort of divide between performance, between brand, between digital, between data, all of that, as we know, is kind of getting blurred. And if that is to happen, then we as marketeers have to be able to master not only those skills, but also the broader set of skills of a commercial person in an organisation. Yeah. So, you know, the leadership stuff, the people stuff, the finance stuff, the legal stuff, it's about kind of raising the bar across lots of areas.
So would your advice be to get experience across the different areas of a business and to understand the different...
So it depends how you get that experience. So I think getting on projects that give you kind of experience... I'm not saying you need to go and work in the legal department. I've never gone and worked in the legal department. But, you know, there are lots of things that you do that have legal exposure. Mm. So getting onto pieces of work like that. I do think... it's kind of a bit ageist to say, but in your 20s, it's all about the capabilities. You know, I've been able to do this, I've been able to do that. You get into the 30s, it's become about what you've done. You know, I led this part of the business, I ran this, I did that. Into your 40s, it's all about what you achieved, what changed as a result of that. I think there is just a sort of shift as you kind of age that you kind of need to kind of go through. And so... what is that assembly of projects that you're putting together that's going to give a really broad offer to any future employer? And what are you going to be able to achieve through that? What can you say that you have done? What's the difference that you made? You know, you can confidently put your name to and feel, yeah, that was me.
What do you want to be remembered for?
Well, I don't know about it. I mean, so I don't think it has to be even that egoic, really. Yeah. Sorry, I'll not push you back, but it's just that there are very few pure marketing problems, unless you work for a very big company that sort of stovepipes it all out. If you work for a smaller company, you're going to be tasked with something which is a bit of this and a bit of that. There's a bit of people in there, there's a bit of digital in there, there's a bit of marketing in there, and a bit of legal. So how do you sort of pull all these threads together?
Hmm. So what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Blimey. I used to work with a bloke at Audi that used to say, everything will pass. And I do think about that. I don't mean... I do think about that when times get bad. I sort of think, yeah, you know, it won't feel like this tomorrow. It'll be great. So kind of get stuck in and get it done and get over it, because everything will pass. Everything does come back to equilibrium. I don't think there is such thing as good or bad, ultimately. There is just this average that kind of runs through the whole thing. And so just you can then approach things with a level of serenity, a level of calmness, whether it's kind of things are going really well or things are going really badly. How do you just try and adopt that sort of leadership centricity, calmness, nice. Levity, measure?
Lots of words there. Excellent. Yeah. So if there's one thing that you know now that you wish you'd have known then when you were your younger self, what would it have been?
So there are no answers. I'm a scouser. I went to a comprehensive school. My parents were teachers. I had no idea about business. And I kind of walked through the front door of a bank, actually, when I first graduated, and just assumed that it was all really well set up, everybody knew what they were doing, it was highly efficient, highly optimised, we were making decisions for sensible reasons. And in all the organisations I've worked with, you've found that that is not the case. And regardless of what level you kind of work with in the organisation, there's always stuff, and it's about people making decisions at points in time, people saying this is what they think the answers are. And so, you know, you shouldn't be intimidated by anything. Really, I don't have any of the badges. You know, I went to a comprehensive school. I went to a crap university. I don't have those sort of smart badges that other people have, and so that was originally quite intimidating, really. And it's taken me quite a long time to kind of get to the point where I'm not intimidated by situations. I'm not intimidated by people. I'm not intimidated by hierarchy in the way that I once was, because I assumed that there was a sort of answer or there was a way of behaving that I didn't understand. And I think you realise that that is not the case.
Interesting. That brings me nicely on to often the human side of leadership is hidden. And we've been doing a lot of events where we've been asking people to tell us a secret on what makes them vulnerable, which has opened up lots of big conversations. So, Peter, what makes you vulnerable?
Vulnerable. Blimey. So I've touched on which is not having all the badges, I think people would call it imposter syndrome now, wouldn't they? I don't feel I have the right to sort of be here, really, in that sort of situation. Everybody else is brighter than me, everybody else is better educated than me, or all that sort of stuff. I think there's definitely one there. I think for me, exclusion, actually, I was the fourth of four kids, and lovely family life, brothers and sisters, and we used to play hide and seek, and I'd go and hide, and they'd never come and find me. They'd just go off and do something else. And so it's just like, I think I am damaged, actually, as a result of that, seriously. So I kind of like to get stuck in on things, and so when things are happening over there that I am not included in, that I am vulnerable there. So I want to be in the thick of things.
You just reminded me of when you won our Marketing Leader of the Year. We always give a heads up to whoever is going to win. We say, if you are announced, we would like you to say a few words. And we only say it to the person that's actually winning.
You don't tell the person who's winning that you're saying that. But if anyone in this room gets those words said to them this year, they'll now know.
This is true, but we're doing it differently now, so it's fine. That would have been slightly awkward, wouldn't it? But I'll never forget when I phoned Peter to say, if you're announced on the evening, I'm phoning all eight of you, and if you're announced on the evening, we'd love you to say a few words. And he says, oh, don't worry, Gemma, I'm always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Which I thought was amazing, that someone as successful and as you, you know, and I mean that in the best possible way, still has that to your point, a bit imposter syndrome. And I think actually admitting that is a great thing, because then other people can admit that.
Well, I don't think I'm alone.
No.
I think lots of people do feel that. And you don't feel it all the time. You don't feel it, you know, on a Tuesday morning. But there are moments when, if you haven't done something before, it's quite natural to feel nervous about it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not very natural to come out and sit here and do this now. No. So it's not unnatural to feel a bit odd about it in advance. Yeah. But it takes you a while to realise that.
I've heard that the only people that don't have imposter syndrome are psychopaths or sociopaths.
Oh.
But the thing is, we don't talk about it enough, which is really interesting. But I was so happy with when he said that, because I thought, you're going to be awarded this on the night, and you are the bride, if you like, on that evening.
How very current.
So I'm being told time's up. So, Peter, what's next for you?
More of the same. I think Just Eat going to strength, hopefully. Yeah. Love it there. So we've got so much to do. And, yeah, it's a fantastic team. Come and see us. Come and see Just Eat Towers. It's brilliant.
If you're an agency, though, you won't get the business.
Yeah, apart from you're a media agency, because we've just done that. Just hopefully more of the same. I love it. Customers, customers, customers.
Nick, if you leave the audience with one piece of advice, and you've shared so much wisdom tonight, but if you could leave with one thing for this brilliant audience of marketeers, what would it be?
Oh, blimey, you could have told me you were going to ask me that.
The whole point is
marketing is crucial. It's just crucial to this economy, to our businesses. And so I think what we do is really important to the success of companies. And I'm not sure it always feels like that in the moment on a day-to-day basis. So just remember that and feel good about that, and celebrate it and bring people into that story.
Lovely. And on that note, Peter Duffy.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you so much. So I've so enjoyed this conversation, and I think there's so much what we'll all take away, but particularly your openness, your humility, your transparency, and I think your kindness. You know, what you said about be nice. I think that's one of the most important things you can be, right?
Thank you.
Don't be a dick. That's what I always say. So we have to always say feedback is a gift, as it is up there, good and bad. It's the only way we learn at the Marketing Society, so we love to hear what you think. Is this the kind of thing that you want us to continue doing? We'd love to hear your feedback. We make it really simple, so we can collect the data, little cards that we've got on everyone's chair. Excellent. And next up, we've got some really good things. Peter mentioned his old boss, not old, but his ex-boss, Caroline.
Don't call
Caroline,
her that.
Definitely won't. She's amazing. I would never call her that. So we've got a conversation with her coming up in June. We have, under the spotlight, we love bringing great leaders in. So the outgoing chief executive of Unilever, Paul Polman, is here for an under the spotlight. And, of course, we have our Brave Awards, which we have just shortlisted and judged the winners. So that's going to be a fantastic evening and some brilliant Brave work. And then later on, because I have to mention it, because my team will kill me otherwise, our Bravest conference. So we started with Brave. Last year was Braver, so this year is Bravest. And we're hosting it, and this is where we are being brave. We're hosting it in 6 countries around the world. Not on the same day, though, because we've done that before where we did four conferences in one day. So this time we're doing it as a roadshow. So actually you can enjoy all of them, which will be very different if you want to travel across New York to India. So lots going on. I hope you enjoyed it. We've got drinks upstairs back where we were before. Try and meet new people. Don't stay with who you came with, because that's what the society is all about, meeting new people. And as Peter said, everything's about relationships and building those, and you start those at events like this. So thank you all very much for coming, and thank you to you for being Cheers. Such a great guest.
Thank you.
We need a picture. We didn't get a picture.
Did we not?
No.